Usually when we think about unlocking a door, the mechanism is, you know, it's pretty predictable. You have a key, you slide it into the lock, the tumblers align, and the door just opens to reveal one specific space.
Right. It's a fixed biological input resulting in a fixed experiential output.
Exactly. But imagine for a second that you are holding a single chemical key. You approach a door, you turn it, and the moment that lock clicks, you are just strapped to a hyperdimensional rocket.
Yeah, a completely saturating high-speed neural detonation.
Right. You are blasted into this blinding geometric reality for roughly, say, 15 minutes. It is overwhelming, it's instantaneous, and before your brain can even, like, categorize what just happened to you, you are dropped abruptly right back into your living room.
It's incredibly fast.
But then you take that exact same chemical key, you approach a different door, turn it, and instead of a rocket ship, you are placed on a slow-moving, heavily navigated riverboat.
A very different kind of journey.
Totally. You embark on this deeply immersive, emotionally agonizing, and profoundly narrative voyage that lasts for 6 solid hours. I mean, you are guided through memories, you are processing deep-seated trauma, and you're physically violently purging.
It's two utterly different universes of human experience.
But here is the mind-bending part. It is the exact same key.
It's the absolute definition of a pharmacological paradox,
yeah.
Really. And it serves as one of the most elegant, complex lessons in how our human physiology actually constructs the reality we experience.
You're listening to a deep dive, and today we are stripping down the pharmacology of N,N-dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, based on some incredible source material from the OOTW Journal.
It's a fascinating paper.
It really is. And our mission right now, for you listening, is to show you exactly how delivery dictates reality. We are going to unpack how a single molecule produces either a 15-minute blinding flash or a 6-hour ceremonial marathon.
Right, and how that massive experiential chasm comes down to one highly specific evolutionary quirk of plant chemistry.
Because we need to look at this not just as like a cultural or visionary phenomenon, but as a masterclass in pharmacokinetics.
Yeah, we definitely have a tendency in modern discourse to fixate entirely on the molecule itself, you know. We isolate the active compound and just assume it holds all the power.
Like it's doing all the work in a vacuum.
Exactly. But this source material forces us to recognize that the environment the molecule is introduced into, specifically the enzymatic landscape of the human gut versus the bloodstream, that entirely rewrites the drug's behavioral code.
So to understand that landscape, we really have to start with the baseline architecture of the key itself.
Right. The shared molecule at the center of both the 15-minute rocket and the 6-hour river is N,N-dimethyltryptamine.
It's a simple tryptamine psychedelic, right?
Structurally, yes. It's an incredibly simple indole alkaloid. I mean, if you look at its molecular structure, it is just 2 steps away from the essential amino acid tryptophan.
Which means it shares a structural backbone with vital stuff we rely on constantly, like serotonin and melatonin.
Yes, exactly. It is also remarkably close to psilocin, which is the active metabolite in magic mushrooms.
Okay, but when someone introduces a massive external dose of DMT into their system, what is actually happening at the synaptic level to just collapse their everyday reality?
Well, the primary mechanism is profound agonism at the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
Okay.
And those receptors are heavily concentrated in the brain's cortex. So when DMT binds to them, it triggers a massive cascade of glutamate release,
which just hyper-excites the cortical neurons.
Right. But to understand the subjective collapse of reality, we really have to look at the default mode network, or the DMN.
Right. The brain's centralized filtering system, the part of the brain that basically maintains the narrative of me.
Exactly that. The DMN is essentially the conductor of your waking consciousness.
Okay.
It filters out the overwhelming noise of all the sensory input so you can actually function, you know, plan, and maintain a consistent sense of self.
So when DMT floods those 5-HT2A receptors, it effectively scrambles the conductor.
It completely loses its grip. Suddenly, different regions of the brain that normally never speak to one another are communicating intensely.
Wow. So the visual cortex becomes hyperconnected to the emotional centers and, like, the memory banks.
Yes. So the hallucination isn't just a trick of the eye. It is the brain completely dropping its standard operating procedures and cross-wiring its own data processing.
It's feeding memories and emotions directly into the visual cortex.
Exactly.
And the source material highlights something that I find genuinely haunting about this molecule.
Oh, about it being endogenous.
Yes. This isn't some synthetic compound cooked up in a mid-century lab or, you know, a rare alkaloid exclusive to a remote jungle vine. This is a molecule that is actively floating around inside you, the listener, right now.
Yeah, endogenous DMT is a documented physiological reality. Trace amounts have been found in human cerebrospinal fluid, blood, and urine.
That is just wild to me.
We actually have the biological machinery, specifically an enzyme called INMT, to synthesize DMT in our own bodies.
Wait, if we are naturally producing a compound capable of entirely dismantling the default mode network, why aren't we just constantly hallucinating?
That is a great question.
Like, what evolutionary purpose does synthesizing our own hyperdimensional psychedelic even serve?
Honestly, that remains one of the most fiercely debated black boxes in modern biology. Yeah, the sheer trace amounts mean it isn't triggering those 5-HT2A receptors in any meaningful psychedelic way under normal conditions.
Okay.
Some neurobiologists theorize it acts as a localized neurotransmitter or a neuromodulator, perhaps involved in immune response or protecting cellular tissue during severe oxidative stress, like cardiac arrest.
Oh, wow. And there is also that heavily popularized, though scientifically unproven, hypothesis that a massive release of endogenous DMT occurs at the moment of death.
The biological transition mechanism, right?
Exactly.
That is the theory, though I should clarify the empirical data to support a massive flood-level release at death in humans is still, well, lacking.
Right. But what the sources confirm is simply that the molecule is native to our biology.
Yes. It's native, but it's fiercely regulated.
Which brings us to the central mechanical conflict of this entire deep dive. If you take this native key, pure N,N-DMT, and you simply swallow it, you know, you just drink it in a glass of water, absolutely nothing happens.
Nothing at all.
Yeah.
Your reality remains perfectly intact.
Your body mounts a completely silent, incredibly efficient defense.
And that defense system is an enzyme called monoamine oxidase, or MAO.
Okay, let's unpack this mechanically. Forget the old analogies of, like, a bouncer at a nightclub door.
Yeah, that doesn't quite cover the severity of it.
Right. Think of your digestive tract as a highly secured chemical sorting facility. When you swallow something, it goes onto the conveyor belt of the gut and the liver.
And stationed all along this conveyor belt are these molecular shredders, the MAO enzymes.
I prefer the shredder analogy because it really speaks to the destructive finality of the process.
It does. MAO is an enzyme specifically evolved to break down monoamines.
Mm-hmm.
In our evolutionary history, this was critical for survival.
How so?
Well, we regularly consume tyramine and other vasoactive amines in our diet, especially in fermented foods, you know, aged meats and certain fruits.
Mm-hmm.
If those amines were allowed to pass from the gut directly into our systemic circulation, they would trigger catastrophic, potentially fatal spikes in blood pressure.
So the MAO shredder is sitting there to neutralize dietary threats.
Exactly. It grabs the amine, rips a specific chemical group off of it, and renders it biologically inert before it can ever reach the bloodstream.
The process is oxidative deamination. Right.
Right. The enzyme physically strips the amine group from the molecule. And because N,N-dimethyltryptamine is fundamentally a monoamine, it is perfectly targeted by these shredders.
So the moment oral DMT hits the gastrointestinal tract,
the MAOA enzymes bind to it and dismantle it.
It never even makes it past the lobby.
Not at all.
I mean, you could eat a bowl of pure DMT crystals, and aside from severe gastrointestinal discomfort, you would not experience a single shift in consciousness.
The key is completely destroyed before it ever reaches the lock in the brain.
Which means any attempt to utilize this molecule requires a biological workaround.
You basically have to bypass the conveyor belt entirely.
And historically, in Western contexts, that meant taking the brute force approach.
Yeah, if the digestive tract is full of shredders, you completely avoid the digestive tract.
You go through the lungs or the veins.
Vaporization and intravenous injection. Both methods exploit alternative pharmacokinetic highways that lead directly to the brain, completely circumventing first-pass metabolism in the liver and gut.
Let's focus on vaporization for a second, because the sheer speed of this mechanism is terrifying.
It really is.
The source data notes a typical vaporized dose is around 20 to 60 milligrams. When a user inhales that vapor, what is the exact pathway that allows it to hijack the brain so violently fast?
Well, when you draw a DMT vapor into the lungs, you are exposing it to the alveoli, which are these millions of microscopic air sacs that have a massive, highly permeable surface area.
Okay.
The DMT molecule is lipophilic, meaning it easily passes through cell membranes. So it crosses the alveolar walls instantly and enters the pulmonary capillaries.
So now it's in the oxygen-rich blood heading straight back to the heart.
Precisely. And then the heart pumps that highly concentrated bolus of DMT-rich blood out through the aorta and straight up the carotid arteries to the brain.
Wow.
Because it's so lipophilic, it crosses the blood-brain barrier without any resistance. There is virtually no MAO in this specific arterial pathway to intercept it.
It's an uninterrupted high-speed rail line directly to the cortex.
Yes, which explains the onset times. The sources state the onset of vaporized DMT happens in under 45 seconds.
And honestly, 45 seconds seems slow compared to some clinical accounts I've heard.
Oh, absolutely. Many users report that the subjective effects begin before they have even finished exhaling the vaser.
That is insane.
The transition is not gradual. It is an immediate high-amplitude wave of receptor saturation. The pharmacokinetic peak hits at roughly 1 minute.
1 single minute from baseline sobriety to the absolute peak of the most profound altered state imaginable.
Yeah.
And then the duration is incredibly brief, right? 5 to 20 minutes before you are back. Now, the MAO in your blood and brain tissue does eventually catch up to clear it out. But for that short window, it's total dominance.
Total dominance is a good way to put it.
But I want to push back heavily on the cultural framing of this brevity.
Okay, sure.
Because the sources note that in the 1960s, this was nicknamed the businessman's trip. The idea was that a stockbroker could smoke DMT on his lunch break, have a quick hallucination, and be back at his desk by 1.00 p.m.
Right, that old myth.
It implies a level of casual manageability. Is a 15-minute duration actually mild?
No, that nickname is one of the most dangerously misleading misnomers in psychedelic history.
Right, there has to be.
The brevity of the experience is inversely proportional to its intensity. Because the entire 60-milligram dose hits the 5-HT2A receptors simultaneously, the psychological impact is arguably the most overwhelming, jarring experience the human nervous system can sustain.
So definitely not a casual lunch break diversion.
Not even close.
The term the sources use repeatedly is a breakthrough. What does a breakthrough actually look like from a neurological and subjective standpoint? Because we aren't talking about seeing breathing walls or like enhanced colors here.
No, a breakthrough is characterized by a complete and total ontological replacement.
Meaning the whole world just swaps out.
Exactly. The sensory input from the physical room you are sitting in is entirely overridden. The default mode network collapses so completely that the user's perception of having a physical body or existing within linear time just evaporates.
Wow.
They report being thrust into a hyperdimensional space that feels completely autonomous and separate from their own subconscious.
Autonomous is the key word there. It doesn't feel like a dream they are generating. It feels like a location they have been violently transported to.
Yes.
And it's populated. The sources bring up Terence McKenna, the famous ethnobotanist, who spent a lot of time categorizing this specific space. He coined the term machine elves.
Yes, the self-transforming machine elves.
Yeah.
McKenna's descriptions really popularized the phenomenon of entity contact in the DMT state.
Right.
Users consistently report interacting with beings, architects, or intelligences that exist within this geometric architecture.
And these entities often seem to be waiting for the user, interacting with them, or communicating through highly complex visual languages.
That's the consistent report, yes.
Then it's so easy for a skeptic to dismiss McKenna as, you know, a 1990s counterculture poet using highly subjective metaphors.
Sure.
But the source material immediately backs this up with rigorous clinical data. Dr. Rick Strassman's research at the University of New Mexico in the early 90s is the ultimate proof that this isn't just hippie lore.
Absolutely. The Strassman trials are foundational to modern psychedelic science.
They really are.
This was the first newly approved U.S. government psychedelic research in over 20 years. He administered roughly 400 intravenous doses of pure DMT to 60 heavily screened, perfectly sober volunteers.
And this was in a highly sterile, heavily monitored hospital environment.
Exactly. So he used IV administration to achieve the exact same rapid pharmacokinetic peak as smoking, bypassing the gut shredders completely.
And the data he collected was just staggering.
It was. He famously titled his subsequent book The Spirit Molecule, largely because his secular clinical volunteers were consistently reporting the exact same phenomena McKenna describes.
Why?
Over half of his subjects reported encountering non-human entities. They were lying in a hospital bed with an IV drip, surrounded by heart monitors, yet subjectively they were interacting with insectoid aliens, angelic beings, or complex geometric intelligences.
Which forces you to ask, like, why does this specific tryptamine molecule consistently trigger the brain to project hyper-intelligent entities?
It's the million-dollar question.
Is it a localized misfiring of our brain's facial recognition software? Are we just anthropomorphizing geometric hallucinations?
We don't really have a definitive answer yet.
Regardless of the underlying neuroscience, the brute force method is clear. You bypass the body's defenses, you saturate the brain in seconds, and reality shatters for 15 minutes.
That's the baseline, yes.
But there is a second door. If we leave the sterile hospital rooms of New Mexico and travel to the Amazon basin, we find a completely inverted approach to this exact same molecule.
A completely different pharmacological hack.
Right. While Western scientists were using IV pumps to avoid the stomach, indigenous populations figured out how to fundamentally reprogram the stomach's chemistry.
And this transition from brute force bypass to sophisticated biochemical engineering is the story of ayahuasca.
It's amazing.
It represents one of the most astonishing leaps in traditional ecological knowledge in human history.
Ayahuasca is a brewed decoction, right? But it's not just a tea made from a DMT-bearing plant. If it were, the MAO shudders in the gut would just destroy it.
Exactly. The genius of the brew is that it deliberately disarms the shredders.
So how do they do that?
To do this, the brew requires two highly specific, biologically distinct plant components acting in perfect concert.
Okay.
First, you need the source of the N and DMT. Throughout much of the Amazon, this is the leaf of Psychotria viridis, a shrub commonly known as chacruna.
So the chacruna leaf provides the VIP molecule.
Yes.
But to get it past the MAO enzymes, they had to find a secondary chemical agent to shut the enzymes down.
Which they found in a sprawling jungle liana, a vine called Banisteriopsis capi.
Okay, the capi vine.
Right. The bark of this vine is pounded, shredded, and boiled alongside the chacruna leaves for hours, sometimes days.
What exactly is leaching out of that vine bark into the boiling water?
A class of alkaloids known as harmala beta carbolines. The primary active compounds are harmaline, harmaline, and tetrahydroharmine.
Okay, let's look at the pharmacology of these beta carbolines. What is their mechanical function when a human drinks this brew?
They act as reversible inhibitors of monoamine oxidase A, or RIMAS.
Okay.
When you ingest the ayahuasca brew, the harmala alkaloids travel down into the gastrointestinal tract and immediately bind to the active sites of the MAOA enzymes in the gut lining and liver.
They literally jam the gears of the shredders.
Exactly. The enzyme is physically blocked from grabbing and deaminating any monoamines.
They occupy the enzyme.
Yes. And because the gears are temporarily jammed, the DMT molecules from the chacruna leaf, which are swimming the exact same mouthful of dark, bitter tea, are suddenly invisible to the body's defense mechanisms.
Wow.
The DMT slips past the neutralized enzymes, absorbs through the intestinal walls into the portal vein, survives the pass through the liver, and enters systemic circulation.
The odds of this discovery are what truly break my brain. The source material touches on this, but let's really contextualize it for you listening.
It's hard to overstate how unlikely it is.
The Amazon basin contains tens of thousands of distinct plant species. You have a pre-scientific indigenous culture operating entirely without mass spectrometry or an understanding of enzymatic pathways.
Right.
And yet, out of this ocean of green, they somehow isolated the exact two plants that perfectly fit this highly specific lock-and-key neuropharmacology. One plant holds the target molecule. The other plant holds the exact temporary chemical jammer required to make the target orally active.
Statistically, finding the combination by trial and error is practically impossible.
It has to be.
I mean, if you boil chacruna alone, nothing happens.
Yeah, yeah.
If you boil the vine alone, you feel mildly dizzy and nauseous, but you don't break through into hyperdimensional space.
The synergy only reveals itself when the two are combined in a very specific, sustained thermal extraction process.
Exactly. It points to a method of deep generational observation of the ecosystem that Western science still, honestly, struggles to accurately model.
And it's crucial to understand that the vine isn't just a passive chemical jammer, right? The harmala beta carbolines don't just hold the door open for the DMT and then stand aside.
No, not at all. They are psychoactive on their own.
This is a vital nuance.
It really is. Tetrahydroharmine, or THH, which is one of the primary alkaloids in the vine, has its own unique pharmacological profile.
Well, what's it do?
It acts as a weak serotonin reuptake inhibitor. It functions very similarly to modern SSRI antidepressants, keeping more serotonin active in the synapses.
So the vine is actively modifying the neurochemical environment that the DMT is about to enter.
It is steering the experience. In fact, within many traditional indigenous frameworks, the capi vine is considered the actual ayahuasca, the vine of the soul or vine of the dead.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is the revered medicine, the teacher, the master plan. The Chacruna leaf is often viewed merely as a secondary additive, the light that illuminates the visions, while the vine dictates the nature, direction, and depth of the journey.
That perfectly frames how the delivery method changes the subjective reality.
Exactly.
By jamming the gut enzymes, the entire pharmacokinetic timeline of the DMT is stretched out and reshaped. We go from the 45-second 4V rail line to a slow, methodical digestive absorption.
Because the DMT is entering the bloodstream through the vast surface area of the inhibited gastrointestinal tract, the onset is fundamentally different.
How long does it take?
It takes roughly 30 to 60 minutes for the user to even begin feeling the initial threshold effects.
It's a slow build. The water is rising around you rather than a tsunami dropping on your head.
Right.
And the duration.
The experience unfolds, peaks, and slowly resolves over a period of 4 to 6 hours, depending on the specific alkaloid concentrations in the brew and the individual's metabolic rate.
Think about the psychological implications of that stress.
It's massive.
A 15-minute smoked breakthrough is so fast, the human brain essentially goes offline. You are a passive observer to a cosmic detonation. You don't have time to reflect on your childhood or process a complicated relationship or analyze your own behavioral loops.
No, it's too fast.
But 6 hours.
6 hours provides a narrative architecture. The ayahuasca space is deeply processual.
Meaning you can work through things.
Yes. Because the DMT is trickling into the receptors rather than slamming them all at once, the user often retains a stronger anchor to their sense of self. They can interact with the visions. They can ask questions.
It becomes a deeply emotional, highly psychological excavation.
That's a perfect way to put it.
And that excavation is famously brutally physical.
Yes, it is.
The sources heavily emphasize la purga, the purge. Smoked DMT does not have a reputation for making people vomit. You blast off, you lie completely still, and you come back.
Right.
But ayahuasca is synonymous with violent, prolonged vomiting and frequently diarrhea. Why does jamming an enzyme in the gut and slowly absorbing DMT cause such a catastrophic physical reaction?
To understand that, we have to look at the gut-brain axis, and specifically the evolutionary biology of serotonin.
Okay.
We talk about serotonin as the mood molecule in the brain, but that is a massive oversimplification. Roughly 90% of the human body's total serotonin is synthesized and located in the enteric nervous system.
Wait, 90%?
Yeah, 90%. It's embedded in the massive web of neurons in the lining of your gastrointestinal tract.
So it's not primarily a brain chemical at all. It's a digestive chemical.
From an evolutionary standpoint, yes, the enteric nervous system is incredibly ancient.
Wow.
Serotonin in the gut primarily regulates motility, you know, the muscle contractions that push food through your system.
Okay, that makes sense.
It also acts as a highly sensitive alarm system. If you ingest a toxin or spoiled food, the enterochromatin cells in your gut release a massive flood of serotonin.
So it's like a biological siren.
Exactly. This massive local spike in serotonin binds to 5-HT3 receptors on the vagus nerve, which immediately sends an emergency signal to the emetic center in the brainstem.
The brainstem gets the signal, we've been poisoned, evacuate everything.
Exactly. It triggers violent peristalsis, vomiting, and diarrhea to expel the threat. Now, apply this architecture to ayahuasca. You are drinking a highly acidic, fibrous jungle sludge that is completely packed with serotonergic alkaloids, the DMT and the harmless.
Right.
Furthermore, you've jammed the MAO enzymes, which means the gut cannot break down any of this excess serotonin.
So you are creating a localized, massive serotonin overload directly in the enteric nervous system.
Yes. The gut's alarm bells are ringing at maximum volume.
The purge is a direct, unavoidable pharmacological consequence of hyperstimulating the gut's serotonin receptors.
It's just simple biology at that point.
That makes profound biological sense. But the source material also insists we respect the traditional interpretation of this mechanism, right?
That's crucial.
For the indigenous practitioners, the physiological vomiting isn't just like a side effect to be mitigated with anti-nausea medication. It is the core functional mechanism of the therapy.
Right. In the traditional worldview, you are not just chemically purging your stomach contents. The medicine is acting as a somatic scanner.
A somatic scanner.
It locates panema, which is stagnant energy, internalized trauma, spiritual illness, or dark thoughts that have embedded themselves in your physical tissues.
Wow.
The violent physical contraction of vomiting is the literal physical expulsion of that psychological poison.
The physical act is inseparable from the spiritual relief. You are vomiting up your depression, your grief, your addiction.
Exactly. And This deep intertwining of the physical ordeal with spiritual meaning explains why ayahuasca has such complex cultural containers.
It requires a highly structured environment to navigate a 6-hour purgative vision.
Definitely. In the Amazon, this is traditionally guided by a curandero who uses specific whistling songs called ícaros to steer the frequency and intensity of the visions,
acting as an anchor for the participants.
Exactly.
But the sources also highlight a fascinating historical evolution of these containers. In the 20th century, we see the rise of the Brazilian syncretic churches, the Union de Vegetal, or UDV, and Santo Daime.
Yes, these groups represent a brilliant cultural synthesis.
How so?
Well, they merge the indigenous knowledge of the ayahuasca brew, which they call huasca, or Daime, with elements of esoteric Christianity, European spiritism, and African diasporic traditions.
That's quite a mix.
It is. In these churches, the brew isn't just a medicine, it is a sacrament.
Right.
It is the direct equivalent of the Eucharist in Catholicism. But rather than a symbolic transubstantiation, it provides a direct, visceral experience of the divine.
Now, there is a historical detail in the sources regarding the origins of this specific two-plant brew that I want to highlight, because it shatters a very common modern assumption.
Well, about the timeline.
Yes. When Westerners travel to retreat centers in Peru or Costa Rica today, they are often sold the idea that this specific combination of chacruna and kapi has been used in this exact format for 5 or 10,000 years.
Right. The romanticized, ancient, unchanged lineage narrative.
Right. Exactly. But the historical and anthropological data suggest that while the use of the kapi vine itself is undoubtedly ancient, the widespread Pan-Amazonian standardization of combining it specifically with DMT-bearing leaves might actually be a relatively recent phenomenon.
The timeline is complex, but many anthropologists point to the brutal disruption of the Amazonian rubber boom in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
How did the rubber boom change a botanical recipe?
Well, the rubber boom brought horrific enslavement, violence, and mass displacement to indigenous populations across the Amazon basin.
Awful.
Tribes that had been historically isolated from one another were suddenly violently thrust together in rubber tapping camps.
Right, so they were forced into close quarters.
This catastrophic social upheaval forced a massive cross-pollination of botanical knowledge. Different tribes shared their distinct plant technologies out of survival. It is highly probable that the specific, highly optimized DMT plus MAOI brew we recognize as ayahuasca today was refined, standardized, and spread widely across the Western Amazon during this period of extreme cultural forced contact, rather than existing as a static recipe for millennia.
It's a sobering reminder that indigenous knowledge is dynamic, evolving, and deeply tied to historical trauma.
Absolutely.
But returning to the biology, this profound alteration we've been tracking, this deliberate jamming of the gut's defense enzymes, doesn't just create the space for a 6-hour visionary purge.
No, it has other consequences.
Right. By actively disabling the body's MAO shredders, you are creating highly specific, severe, and potentially lethal medical vulnerabilities.
This is the critical pivot from anthropology to modern clinical safety.
Yes.
The two delivery methods we are discussing have radically different risk profiles, and the danger of ayahuasca lies almost entirely in the enzyme block.
Let's establish the safety baseline with pure smoked DMT first. If someone is vaporizing the molecule and bypassing the gut completely, what are the actual medical risks?
Physiologically, the risks of pure vaporized DMT are surprisingly low for healthy individuals.
Really?
Yeah. There is a transient sharp spike in heart rate and blood pressure during the onset, which could theoretically trigger an event in someone with severe pre-existing cardiovascular disease or an aneurysm.
But generally.
But the molecule itself has practically zero physiological toxicity. It builds no physical dependence, and the body clears it so rapidly that cumulative physical damage is practically non-existent.
So the primary risk of the brute force method is psychological.
Entirely. The sheer violence of the transition can induce profound ontological shock, panic attacks, or PTSD-like symptoms if the user resists the experience.
Makes sense.
Furthermore, like all classic serotonergic psychedelics, it carries the significant risk of triggering latent mania or psychosis in individuals predisposed to bipolar disorder or schizophrenia.
Okay, so that is the baseline risk of the ki itself. But when you brew that ki into ayahuasca, you inherit all of those psychological risks, and then you add a massive compounding layer of physiological danger.
Because you aren't just taking a drug. You are actively turning off your body's waste management system.
Right. You have disabled the MAO enzyme. We already established that MAO breaks down the DMT, but it also breaks down the natural serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, that your brain is constantly producing and recycling.
MAO is the crucial regulator that prevents these neurotransmitters from building up to toxic levels in the synaptic clefts.
If the shredders are turned off for 6 hours, your body cannot clean up its own serotonin.
Exactly. Now, consider what happens if a modern person living a modern lifestyle drinks ayahuasca while also taking a daily SSRI antidepressant like Prozac or Lexapro.
An SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, is designed to stop the brain from reabsorbing serotonin, keeping more of it active in the synapses to boost mood.
Right. So the SSRI is actively piling up serotonin in the brain. Normally, the MAO enzyme comes along and shreds the excess to maintain a safe balance.
But the ayahuasca vine has jammed the MAO enzyme.
You now have a drug actively piling up serotonin and another drug completely blocking its removal.
The serotonin levels just skyrocket exponentially with no ceiling.
And this triggers a medical emergency known as serotonin syndrome.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
It's lethal. The toxic buildup of serotonin causes the nervous system to misfire catastrophically. Symptoms begin with severe agitation, heavy sweating, shivering, and hyperreflexia, muscle twitching.
Okay.
As toxicity increases, it leads to a dangerously high fever, extreme confusion, seizures, rhabdomyolysis where muscle tissue breaks down, and if left untreated, coma and death.
It is a lethal biochemical bottleneck. And it's not just SSRIs, right? The sources list several absolute contraindications.
Right. Any drug that releases serotonin or prevents its reuptake is a fatal risk.
Like what else?
This includes SNRIs, recreational and pathogens like MDMA or ecstasy, and even seemingly benign over-the-counter cough suppressants containing dextromethorphan or DXM.
Wow, even cough medicine.
Yeah. Furthermore, because MAO also regulates dopamine and norepinephrine, combining ayahuasca with central nervous system stimulants like cocaine, amphetamines, or even massive doses of caffeine can trigger a hypertensive crisis.
The trapped norepinephrine causes blood vessels to constrict so violently it can induce a stroke.
Precisely.
So the medical vetting required for an ayahuasca ceremony is incredibly rigid. You have to be completely clean of an entire spectrum of modern pharmaceuticals.
You absolutely do.
But I want to clarify a very specific nuance regarding the traditional ayahuasca diet, because I think a lot of people misinterpret the chemistry here.
The tyramine diet.
Yeah. When doctors hear MAO inhibitor, they immediately think of the strict pharmaceutical dietary restrictions from the 1960s, the famous cheese effect.
Yes. Early pharmaceutical antidepressants were irreversible MAOIs.
Meaning?
They didn't just temporarily jam the enzyme, they permanently bonded to it and destroyed it. The body had to synthesize entirely new MAO enzymes from scratch, which took up to 2 weeks.
So for 2 weeks, your gut had absolutely zero shredders.
Meaning, if you ate foods rich in tyrannage cheeses, cured meats, fermented soy, draft beer, that tyramine would flood unopposed into your bloodstream, causing a massive, potentially fatal hypertensive spike.
But the sources specify that the harmala alkaloids in the ayahuasca vine are RIMA's reversible inhibitors of monoamine oxidase A.
This is the crucial distinction. They are competitive, reversible inhibitors.
Okay, so they don't destroy the enzyme.
Right. They hold on to the enzyme, but they don't destroy it. If a massive amount of dietary tyramine suddenly arrives in the gut, it can actually outcompete the harmala alkaloids.
Oh.
The tyramine effectively pushes the vine alkaloids off the enzyme, freeing the MAO to do its job and shred the tyramine.
The chemical jammer gets bumped out of the lock. So what does that mean for the dietary restrictions we hear so much about? You hear about people going on these incredibly bland diets for weeks before a ceremony.
While a bland diet can certainly prepare the body and mind, the actual physiological danger of dietary tyramine causing a fatal hypertensive crisis with ayahuasca is significantly overstated in popular culture.
Interesting.
The competitive binding of RIMAs makes it very difficult to achieve lethal tyramine toxicity from food alone during a ceremony.
But the drugs?
The real, absolute, uncompromisable danger is the drug-to-drug interaction with serotonergic medications. You cannot outcompete an SSRI.
So, synthesizing all of this, we have a molecule that induces hyperdimensional hallucinations, an administration route that involves 6 hours of violent purging, and a pharmacological mechanism that can cause fatal serotonin syndrome if mixed with modern antidepressants.
It's a complicated profile.
Despite these massive, complex hurdles, modern clinical science is actively trying to fold both of these delivery methods into mainstream medicine. Where exactly does the science stand as of the source material's context in 2026?
Well, for decades, ayahuasca was considered just too messy for Western clinical trials.
I can see why.
The botanical variation in the brew, the extreme physical purging, and the six-hour duration made standardized placebo-controlled trials seem impossible. But researchers in Brazil shatter that assumption.
The sources detail a landmark 2019 trial led by Dr. Fernanda Palano Fontes.
Yes, a very important study.
Let's break down the methodology of this study, because running a placebo control on a psychedelic that makes you vomit and hallucinate for hours seems structurally impossible.
It is the great methodological crisis of psychedelic science.
I mean, if I give you a sugar pill and you don't end up talking to machine elves in the bathroom, the blind is instantly broken. You know you got the placebo.
Exactly. So to maintain the blind, Palano Fontes and her team had to engineer an active placebo.
What was it?
They created a brownish, bitter liquid that mimicked the exact taste and texture of ayahuasca.
Okay.
More importantly, they laced it with low doses of zinc sulfate to induce mild gastrointestinal distress and nausea, and a very low dose of a mild sedative to create an altered fuzzy headspace.
So the placebo group drinks a bitter tea, feels a bit weird, and gets nauseous, mimicking the physical onset of the real brew.
Right, it's a very clever design.
Who are the patients they were testing this on?
This is the most important part. They weren't testing healthy volunteers. They specifically selected patients suffering from treatment-resistant depression.
Okay.
These are individuals who have run the gauntlet of modern psychiatry. They have failed multiple courses of standard SSRIs, SNRIs, and behavioral therapies. Their depression is entrenched and unyielding.
And the results of giving this population a single dose of ayahuasca.
The data was a paradigm shift. Mm. At day 7 post-dosing, a staggering 64% of the patients who received the actual ayahuasca brew showed a clinically significant reduction in their depressive symptoms.
64%.
Compare that to only 27% in the active placebo group.
64% of people whose depression was completely immune to modern medicine found massive relief from a single six-hour biochemical cascade.
Yes.
What is it about the ayahuasca experience that achieves that? Is it the massive neuroplasticity triggered by the DMT, or is it the psychological processing afforded by the six-hour duration?
It is inextricably both.
Okay.
The 5-HT2A agonism triggers a flood of brain-derived neurotrophic factor BDNF, which acts like fertilizer for the brain,
promoting the growth of new neural connections.
Exactly, and allowing entrenched depressive neural loops to physically rewire.
And the duration.
Simultaneously, the six-hour duration allows the patient to navigate their trauma, process their grief, and achieve a level of emotional catharsis that talk therapy might take years to reach.
But despite that massive success, the sources note that the pharmaceutical industry and many clinical researchers are currently pivoting their focus away from the ayahuasca brew and back toward pure, isolated DMT.
Yeah, they are.
Why? If the six-hour journey is so healing, why go back to the 15-minute brute force method?
It entirely comes down to the brutal economics and logistics of the modern healthcare system. Scalability.
Unpack that for us.
If a clinic wants to run an ayahuasca therapy session, they need a dedicated, highly comfortable room for 8 to 10 hours.
Right.
They need at least 2 trained facilitators or medical staff present the entire time to monitor the patient through the hallucinations and the physical purging.
The overhead cost of that single session is astronomical.
You cannot scale that model to treat the millions of people suffering from depression.
But a pure DMT session.
Pure DMT session, utilizing an intramuscular injection or an IV bolus, induces the breakthrough state, peaks rapidly, and is completely metabolized in under 30 minutes.
That's incredibly fast.
A patient could arrive at a clinic at 9:00 a.m., have a profound, reality-resetting, mystical experience, spend an hour doing integration therapy with a clinician, and be walking out the door by noon.
So a single clinic room could treat 4 patients a day instead of 1.
Exactly. The efficiency of the brute force method makes it commercially viable.
But if 15 minutes is too short to do any real therapeutic processing and 6 hours is too expensive, is there a middle ground?
There is, actually.
The source material introduces a technological concept that sounds like absolute science fiction, DMTX.
DMTX, or extended state DMT, represents the bleeding edge of pharmacokinetic engineering.
How does it work?
Researchers recognize the problem. The peak state of pure DMT is uniquely fascinating, but the brain clears it too quickly to properly map the neural activity with an fMRI, and the user is violently ejected before they can meaningfully interact with the state.
So how do you hold the door open?
You borrow technology from anesthesiology, target-controlled intravenous infusion.
Like when you are put under for surgery, And a computer pump constantly adjusts the drip to keep you perfectly unconscious without killing you?
Exactly the same principle. Pharmacologists mapped the precise metabolic clearance rate of pure DMT in the human body.
Okay.
By using a computerized IV pump, they can deliver an initial bolus of DMT to punch the user through the breakthrough threshold, and then the pump instantly switches to a continuous micro-adjusted maintenance drip.
And the drip matches the shredders.
The drip delivers the DMT at the exact mathematical rate that the body's MAO is shredding it.
It perfectly balances the equation. The shredders are running at maximum capacity, but the pump is feeding the conveyor belt at the exact same speed.
The result is that the user is suspended at the absolute peak of the hyperdimensional breakthrough state.
Wow.
They aren't dropping back to reality after 5 minutes. The researchers can hold them in that peak space for 30 minutes, an hour, or potentially much longer.
That is staggering. We have gone from pre-scientific tribes boiling bark in the Amazon to neutralize an enzyme to modern pharmacologists using computerized IV algorithms to artificially suspend a human consciousness in a hyperdimensional alien landscape.
It is the ultimate evolution of the delivery mechanism.
But none of this clinical innovation and none of this traditional practice exists in a vacuum.
No, it certainly doesn't.
It all collides violently with the legal reality of 2026. Because if a lab tries to study this or a church tries to drink it, they hit a massive brick wall.
The legal architecture is built on deep contradictions.
How so?
In the United States, the baseline reality is the Controlled Substances Act. Under this framework, both pure N and DMT and any preparation containing it, like ayahuasca, are firmly classified as Schedule I.
Meaning the federal government officially declares they have a high potential for abuse, no accepted safety protocols under medical supervision, and absolutely no accepted medical use.
Which directly contradicts the Pujano Fuentes trial we just discussed.
Right. It is a legislative categorization that completely ignores the emerging clinical data.
However, the American legal landscape has carved out highly specific, incredibly hard-fought exemptions based not on medicine, but on religious freedom.
The Brazilian syncretic churches we talked about.
Yes. The Union do Vegetal, or UDV. In 1999, U.S. Customs seized a massive shipment of the UDV's sacramental ayahuasca tea.
Okay.
The church sued the federal government, arguing that preventing them from drinking the tea violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA.
Because for them, it's not a drug. It is the literal foundation of their religious practice. If you take away the tea, you take away the religion.
Exactly. This legal battle raged for years, ultimately reaching the United States Supreme Court in 2006.
The Gonzalez v. Centro Espirita case.
And in a stunning decision, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously, 8-0, in favor of the church.
The Supreme Court unanimously protected a Schedulite hallucinogen. On what grounds?
They ruled that the government had failed to demonstrate a compelling interest in barring the UDV's highly specific, controlled, and religiously sincere use of the sacrament.
Interesting.
The church had strict internal guidelines, rigorous screening, and a track record of safety. The court essentially said that religious liberty supersedes the blanket drug prohibition in this highly specific context.
Which created a massive legal paradox. The exact same molecule and the exact same delivery mechanism is a federal crime if I brewed in my kitchen, but a constitutionally protected sacrament if brewed by a legally recognized church member.
And that precedent expanded.
It did.
In 2009, a federal district court extended similar RFRA protections to a branch of the Santa Dame Church in Oregon.
So within the United States, we have these tiny protected islands of legal ceremonial use floating in a sea of total federal prohibition.
And if we zoom out internationally, the legal map is just as fractured.
Yeah, right.
In Peru, ayahuasca isn't just legal. It is officially recognized and protected by the state as a pillar of their national cultural heritage.
Oh, wow.
In Brazil, its use within religious contexts is entirely legal and federally regulated.
But in other places.
But conversely, in countries like France, the government moved aggressively to ban not just the chemical DMT, but the actual botanical plants themselves. The copy vine and the chacruna leaves are strictly scheduled.
And even at the local level within the U.S., the ground is shifting beneath the federal laws.
We are seeing a wave of municipal decriminalization.
Like where?
Cities like Oakland, Santa Cruz, Ann Arbor, and several others have passed local resolutions directing their city police departments to make the arrest and prosecution of adults using natural plant medicines, including ayahuasca, the absolute lowest law enforcement priority.
It is a totally patchwork, chaotic legal frontier driven entirely by how the culture perceives the delivery mechanism. And that is exactly where we need to pull this entire complex narrative back together for you, the listener. Think about the journey we just took.
It's a lot to process.
It is. We started with a single, simple molecule, N-DMT, a key that naturally floats in your own spinal fluid. If you take that key and force it straight into the bloodstream, bypassing the body's natural defenses, you get the brute force breakthrough.
A 15-minute overwhelming detonation of the default mode network.
Right. You are transported to a hyperdimensional space, interacting with autonomous entities while the MAO enzymes in your blood desperately race to tear the molecules apart and bring you back to sobriety.
It is the pharmacology of pure speed and saturation.
But if you take that exact same key and you apply an ancient, chemically perfect hack, if you brew it with a vine that temporarily jams those MAO enzymes, the entire universe shifts.
15-minute rocket becomes a 6-hour riverboat.
The intense physical purging expels the massive serotonin buildup in your gut, while the slow trickle of DMT into your brain allows you to process trauma, rewire depressive loops, and navigate a profoundly spiritual landscape.
The difference between a Schedule A narcotic, a psychiatric breakthrough, and a constitutionally protected religious sacrament comes down entirely to the duration of the biological absorption.
The delivery method is the experience.
It is a perfectly elegant system of biological locks and keys.
But before we sign off, I know you always look at the source material and find one final unsettling extrapolation to leave us with. What is the final takeaway here?
It's something that fundamentally recontextualizes how we view our own daily existence. We just spent an hour breaking down how temporarily jamming one single enzyme in your gut MAO completely dismantles your perception of time, space, and self for 6 hours.
Right.
It collapses the walls of your reality and replaces them with an alien architecture.
Just one enzyme failing to do its job.
Precisely. Which forces a deeply provocative realization. The baseline sober reality you're experiencing right now, the room you are sitting in, the linear flow of time you feel, the solid boundary of your own ego, that is not a default state of the universe.
Wow.
It is a highly precarious, actively constructed neurochemical hallucination. And it was only being maintained because a massive, invisible symphony of endogenous enzymes is working perfectly every millisecond, continuously shredding and regulating the chemicals in your brain.
Your sobriety is an active biological effort.
If turning off just one cleanup crew drops you into another dimension, it begs the question, what other invisible chemical envelopes are quietly shaping the limitations of the reality you think is so absolute right now?
That is a thought that will absolutely stay with you. We trust our sober perception implicitly, but it's just the end product of a very hardworking digestive tract and a hyperactive filtering network. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the locks, keep questioning the keys, and we'll catch you on the next one.